From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the November 2020 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Top Secret Misinformation, Part 1.
In January this year, we sat in the archive recording our Enigma Unlocked episode. But little did we know that that was actually going to be the last time the podcast team was physically in a room together until today. So today I have with me...
Erica Munro.
David Kenyon.
Thomas Cheetham.
The gang's back together.
Now, we asked our comms team to ask you, our listeners, for some questions. And that's what this episode's going to be about. So I'm going to take a back seat now because basically... Well, I've been the podcast for the whole of the year and these three need to catch up as they haven't put enough hours in for the podcast. So over to you.
Thank you, Mark. We've had some great questions sent to us through different channels on social media. And our plan today is to set these challenges to our historians and see if they can give us some answers. Some questions are pretty tricky. Some represent some of the bigger myths that we come across here at Bletchley Park. I think we should start and go straight in with a question that certainly I've heard a number of times, which is from Steve, who's come to us on Facebook with the question, were all the Enigma messages broken? David.
No.
Thanks for that.
And that's it. Next question.
One of the big misconceptions that people have, and you hear this in the media, is people talk about the Enigma code, or as if this is a single thing that once you've figured out Enigma or you've captured a machine or whatever, then your problems are solved because you just read every message from that point on. Actually, it doesn't work like that at all. The secrecy of the Enigma cipher system lies in the individual way you set up the machine when you send a message, the so-called key. And as we've said before, there are something like 103,000 million, million, million possible keys. So the machine is theoretically extremely secure. But the way this worked from the German point of view, was that each network of radio stations communicating with each other would use a key and they would change it every 24 hours. And within that daily key, each message was also sent in a subsidiary individual message key that applied only to that individual message. So breaking Enigma isn't about solving it once and having all your questions answered for the rest of the war. It's about solving each key every day, repeatedly, day after day, until the war ends. And it's made even more difficult by the fact that there isn't just one key in use at any time. At the beginning of the war, the Germans are probably only using half a dozen, but the numbers mount very, very quickly. By the time you get to 1942, more than 50 keys have been identified by Bletchley. And by the time you get to the end of the war, a total of 206 separate keys had been identified that had been in use at one point or another during the war. So basically, you have to break Enigma fresh every day, and you have to do it on more than one key.
You're saying that there were radio stations sending these messages to one another. So because it was radio, messages could be heard, even though they were enciphered. The question, were all the Enigma messages broken? Were all the Enigma messages actually intercepted to be broken?
By no means. I mean, the Y stations are limited by where the radio messages are coming from, you know, atmospheric conditions, all the rest of it. You're not going to hear every message that's transmitted around the world. Secondly, there's not enough operators to take down all those messages. So even the mass of material collected by the Y stations is only a fraction of the amount of stuff that the Germans, in the case of Enigma, are putting on the airwaves in the first place. So it's a partial slice that the Y stations collect. And then even that slice gets sliced further as it goes through the decryption process.
Were there any decisions being made about not analysing Enigma messages? So not all the Enigma messages that were sent were intercepted. Were all the intercepted messages actually dealt with, if they could be dealt with? Or were there decisions like some get analysed and read and some don't?
Not necessarily. Basically, every day, the code breakers have choices to make because many of the German signals out there will be routine administrative messages. They all contain some intelligence, but some are more important than others. If there's particular battles going on land, sea, or in the air, somewhere around, you're going to want to concentrate your attention on where the action is. But also, some of the messages are sent on networks which had procedures that meant that those keys were quite easy to unlock. The German Red Luftwaffe key, for example, was quite predictable and relatively easy to break. Some of the others were very difficult to break. So you have to strike a balance between trying to break the stuff that you think you're going to be able to break, but also the stuff that is going to contain useful intelligence information once you've done that. And so every day there was a sort of, there was a committee that met that kind of tried to figure out what stuff they should target the listeners on. And this is another misconception that people in Y stations were sitting there with a receiver set, just kind of randomly dialing through the frequencies to see if they could hear anything. Actually, most of them would have a piece of paper on their desk with a whole series of frequencies, which Bletchley already knew were being used. And it'd be like, your job for today is to listen to those particular frequencies and see if you hear anything on them. So it's much more targeted. It's not just a sort of random listening in process. But even then, once you've collected those messages, there's no guarantee that the keys are going to come out for that day. So you might have collected a whole raft of messages on one particular network. But if in there isn't one message that you can use to get a crib, to run a bomb, to find the key for the day, then all those other messages are unreadable. So it's by no means a guarantee. And the history of Hut 6, actually, they worked out some of the statistics on this. And if you go to around the period of D-Day, which is when things are sort of at their peak, at that point, they reckoned that there were probably 128 keys in operation on any one day on average. And typically they were breaking 24 of those on average. So it's roughly one in five of the keys they're collecting on any one day are the ones they're actually getting into. So it's about 20% of the collected traffic. And even that is, as we said, a much smaller proportion of what's actually being transmitted.
What does that actually mean? We know the number of keys, but what does that mean in terms of quantity of material?
Again, if you look at the peak effort in 1944, that represents coming into Hut 6, so Army and Air Force Enigma, between 3,500 and 4,000 individual messages every day, every 24 hours. So there's a huge quantity of material, and the first task is to find one of those messages, as I say, that you can use to write a bomb menu to get the key out. And then once you've done that, you then have to process all of the others. Each message is limited to 250 characters. They average at about 100 and something characters. So if you do the maths on that, you're talking about around 250,000 characters of text per day being decrypted in Hut 6, which is quite a lot of words, quite a lot of information. This is the thing. It's, in some senses, it's a tiny fraction of what's out there, but actually it still amounts to a huge volume of material.
You've mentioned Army and Air Force. Is there a Navy side of the story as well?
There is. And actually, this was best summarised by the man who did the job himself, Hugh Alexander, who was head of Hut 8, wrote A Cryptographic History of Naval Enigma, it's called. And he gave a detailed account of how successful Hut 8 had been against Naval Enigma. And we can hear his own summary of that. This is voiced as ever by our voice artist, Mr. Ben Thompson. It's nice to have him back with the team again as well.
Traffic steadily increased throughout the war, from about 300 messages a day in 1940, up to 1,500 to 2,000 messages in 1944 and 1945. Despite the decrease in the area controlled by the Germans, traffic continued to increase almost to the very end, the record intercept being 2,133 messages on March the 12th, 1945. At the same time, the number of keys in use also increased. And whereas in 1941 we had one main key to deal with, Dolphin, plus its Offizier, Oyster, all our keys had the names of sea fishes, the Offiziers as the hardest to break being shellfish, there are about 20 keys in use by the end of the war, most of which we were either breaking regularly or had broken often enough to see that they were not worth further work.
From Cryptographic History of Naval Enigma, by Hugh Alexander.
Another history of Hut 8 was written by A.P. Mahn, who took over from Alexander towards the end of the war. And he told us exactly how many messages the Hut had broken by 1945.
Hut 8's accomplishment consisted in decoding during the course of the war about 1,120,000 messages. The total number of intercepts received was about 1,550,000. It is remarkable that since regular breaking began in the autumn of 1941, The situation has always been under control and no important key has ever ceased to be broken, with the exception of Shark, between February and December 1942.
From The History of Hut 8, 1939 to 1945, by A.P. Mahn.
What you can see from that is that the work in Hut 8 is not quite as much as Hut 6, but it's certainly they're doing a comparable job. Where Hut 6 are processing perhaps 3,000 or more messages a day, Hut 8 is doing between 1,500 and 2,000. They're also tackling fewer keys. The German Navy only used about 20 keys in total. But you have to remember that some of these are extremely tricky. You've got the four-rotor Enigma, you've got Shark, and even their normal three-rotor systems, they used a way of setting up the keys, selecting the settings and describing the settings in the messages, which was vastly more complicated than the way it was done by the Army and the Air Force. So although they're producing less, it's a much more tricky process. And you can also work out from the numbers that of all the messages they're getting, they're managing to read about 70%, which is substantially better than Hut 6, who are reading about 40% of their messages. But again, Hut 6 are dealing with a much larger volume. So although they're not reading as many of them out of the whole total, they're still reading more.
Our next question is from Harold via Facebook, and he's asked us, were the staff at Bletchley Park really all dons and debutantes?
Yeah, sure. So this is a really good question because we have a really good stereotype of the kind of people who worked here. And we have, on the one hand, university type men, mostly professors, probably wearing tweed, probably somewhere near a chess set, very intellectual, love crosswords, etc., etc. And helping them out, I mean, the men are front and centre, but helping them out, a token number of women who are popularly known as Debs, you know, they're known to be quite upper class, or at least upper middle class, well brought up young women who do all the paperwork and everything else. And we see the stereotype throughout popular media, especially in films, you know, like The Imitation Game, that many people will have seen.
Is this simply not true?
It's not completely untrue, and that's why it's tricky to pick this apart. The dons and debs idea, definitely there's an element of truth there if we look at how the organisation develops. So before the war, the Government Code and Cipher School, it's an established organisation, it's part of the Foreign Office. I mean, it's another misconception that Bletchley Park came about in 1939. That's not true. The GCNCS had been around since 1919, and they were civil servants. They were recruited through the Civil Service Commission. The requirements, obviously, for intelligence and for linguistic ability were pretty high, and that meant they were relatively upper class. They would have been university educated, but they were not university dons per se, though they had lots of links with that world. In the run-up to the war, Alistair Denniston, who's in charge of GCNCS, makes plans to possibly expand the organisation should a war break out, you know, purely sort of theoretical. But he leverages his contacts in the universities and the contacts of some of the people who work for him to find people who he might be able to recruit. And he calls these memorably men of the professor type. And so he knows the sort of person he wants. And they are the sort of archetypal don, intellectual, university-based, obviously mostly from Oxford and Cambridge, which is where he has most success. Among them is Alan Turing. There's other people like Gordon Welshman, who also makes a big contribution to Bletchley Park, and people who don't join in the end, like J.R.R. Tolkien. And so Denniston goes to these high tables at these university colleges and exploits his personal contacts there to find people who might fit into his organisation. Codebreaking is always quite a close-knit community at that stage, and it's always very hard to explain to somebody who's outside that world what's required. So you need people who've got an insight into how the organisation functions, who can spot people and say they'll be a good fit. And it's also helpful if you know people already and you have people who can vouch for their reliability. That helps with security, because obviously everyone has to be security checked. This is all pretty secret work.
You say they come from a fairly small pool of candidates in that way in order to keep secrecy. But why is it he went for men of the professor type? What is it of the professor type that specifically he was looking for?
He's looking for intellectualism. Mm-hmm. He's looking for people who are open-minded, he's looking for people who are intelligent and can work their way around problems. He's not just opened the doors to all academics, though, because at this stage he's looking for two people. He's looking for the classical codebreaker, who is a classicist and therefore a linguist and good at interpreting ancient languages. And he's looking for mathematicians at this stage, not just any mathematicians, though, but what we would now call computer scientists, but mathematicians who are interested in the practical application of mathematics to real-world problems, and particularly the ideas about doing calculations with machines that are coming about in the 1930s. We haven't quite got onto computing, but we're getting there. So a certain type of mathematician is somebody who shows up in his research. It's worth saying that two of the men of the professor type who he identifies are actually women. Female classicists at universities. Fiona Margaret Ead is one of them, and the other is Amy Marjorie Dale, and they're both female dons, but they come under the men of the professor type. Alongside the men and a couple of women, there's also a list of what they call emergency clerical staff, and these are more women who are expected to take on more of the donkey work, the day-to-day management of registering messages and jobs like that. Which is not really, is slightly below the standards of work for the male codebreakers. But this is a manner of presentation, I suppose, which is acceptable in the mindset of the time. But actually, a lot of these women are very capable codebreakers in their own right. Some of them are First World War veterans, and they've proved that they know their way around the work. And some of them will make really important contributions in the war. But it's just not the case that you can go to the Foreign Office recruiters and say, I want to bring in all these women who don't have any particular qualifications and aren't in, you know, senior university positions, and pay them the same as men for doing this work. So they go on a separate list.
Is this where, in that early days, the sort of pre-war and the start of the war, that debutante's kind of stereotype comes from?
Yeah, so alongside those First World War veterans, you've also got a lot of younger women who are mostly upper class. And partly, again, this is because of recruiting through those personal connections. And it's partly because the sort of women who are going to have the required qualifications to go to university, which is still very rare at that time, are going to be relatively upper class anyway. And a lot of these women, actually, they hadn't gone to university, but they actually spent time abroad on the continent especially, so they'd gone and become bilingual or multilingual in languages such as German and Italian. So they were perfect linguists. And whatever you want to say about the sort of cozy, almost cronyism going on here, they were very well suited for the job, and many of them performed very, very well. So you have women come in, especially a lot of these women seem to have served in Hut 4, and they're especially known for their debs. Women such as Ursula Benning, who went out with Prince Philip for a time, and Jean Campbell Harris, who became Baroness Trumpington over down the line. But as I say, the evidence we have is that they all perform exceptionally well, and they really are recruited at a base level of intelligence and aptitude for the job. So early on, you have dons and debs. That's not inaccurate to say. It's not quite as consistent a picture maybe as the stereotype bears out. And it's also a much bigger organisation than the stereotype, because we have get an image from the films that there are only a few men here and there are probably about 20 women, but actually the organisation is 150 strong when the war starts, and it only gets bigger. What I find very interesting is we have a lot of the documentation from the Foreign Office, from the Ministry of Labour, and people who are outside Bletchley Park but are recruiting for the organisation. And you realise that very quickly the stereotype takes hold and starts to spread. And the stereotype, which came about in 1939, 1940, at the start of the war, really comes down to us directly. It's the same stereotype about the park we have today. But it would become more and more inaccurate as the organisation grew. So very quickly, the managers at Bletchley Park are having to quash these stereotypes to get the kind of people they really want.
The Ministry of Labour, 18th of September, 1941. The most likely type of applicant is a young woman who has been to a good secondary school and perhaps, though not necessarily, to a university. Those who have taken first or second class honours are not required. Such persons should be considered for administrative posts, and they ought not to be included in the field for these executive vacancies. A person who has taken a pass degree or a third class honours degree should be suitable. Candidates should be alert and distinctly above the average in intelligence, and capacity for concentration and sustained effort is essential. Experience is less important than intelligence, ingenuity, and resistance. People who can enjoy solving or trying to solve rather tedious mathematical problems or Torquemada's crosswords would have the right kind of mentality. There may also be some people on the register who, because of their social position, would find it difficult to settle down in an ordinary office. This difficulty should not arise in the present instance, and, While it may appear snobbish to have regard to considerations of this kind, the fact must be faced that those already in post in the establishment in question belong to a certain social grade, and people who move in the same circles would more easily fit themselves into the present organisation.
This is a really interesting document because, well, first you see that actually the qualification bar has been lowered a bit. That's the sort of objective information that people like Denniston can give people at the Ministry of Labour and say, we don't need people with degrees anymore. Undergraduates are fine. They've been to university, they don't necessarily have to have passed, but we need intelligent people. The intelligence comes through really strongly. The association of the code breakers with puzzles is really apparent. And also in this final part, we have a comment that basically alludes to the class breakdown of GC and CS. But, you know, even this early in the war, even in by September 1941, this stereotype is becoming a bit outdated. So Denniston has to reply and urge the recruiters to row back a bit on these assumptions that they're making and broaden the pool a little bit. So Denniston writes back, you know, in reply to this memo that's been prepared for the recruiters and says, it's no good talking about Torquemada's crossword puzzles, and the question of social status can now be disregarded as we have people from every type of life. So Denniston replies in quite a sort of officious managerial way. But we also have a really nice quote I found from a Mrs. Vivian who was basically involved in HR work. And she says, no administration can guarantee square holes for all the square pegs, and I challenge the nation to produce a community with a greater variety of pegs than Bletchley Park. So the managers, they really have a sense that they want to get across to the recruiters that this is a very diverse place and that anyone can fit in as long as they obviously have the intelligence and the aptitude. I say intelligence, but the other side of this coin is that actually the organisation diversifies because the work generally becomes less demanding. And this is to do with how they're basically automating the process of code breaking. And they're turning the site from a few people in small huts into a sort of industrial scale code breaking organisation. So they would take their code breaking tasks, whatever they might be, and split them into as many smaller stages as was possible. And basically do what had been done in the factories with division of labour. And instead of expecting one or a few experts to carry out every step in the code-breaking process, you get more people to do it, and they had to know less about the process. They only had to know their particular job. And we have a lot of oral history of people who came here. They would sit down at a desk. They would get a stack of papers. They would carry out some sort of function to these papers. They would add numbers, subtract numbers, swap letters for other letters, whatever they'd been trained to do. And then the paper would go off to somebody else. They would not know where it went. That was just their part of the process. And this means actually the main thing you're looking for in recruits is not pure intelligence, it's the ability to do quite a boring task every day and keep your focus and not make mistakes, because it was still the case that tiny mistakes could have big consequences on the success of the effort. And eventually we get to a point where, you know, your average school leaver is perfectly capable of fitting into the organisation. And the park is also able to draw upon its biggest available pool of labour, which is young women, because with a war on, you know, increasing numbers of the men are joining the armed forces, or they're, for example, being conscripted into the mines. But the sort of code-breaking work is something that young women are considered capable of doing, and they're increasingly available. And a big source of these, of course, is the women's services. So you have the WRENs, you have the WAFs, and you have the ATS, and they all fulfil different roles in the organisation, basically depending on what the specialism was of their service and what those services were gaining from Bletchley Park. So the RAF are experts in communications, and in the end, they take over all the communication for the park, and most of the WAFs work in communications, or they work in the air section, obviously doing air codes. The WRENs operate the bomb machines. That's mainly because the Admiralty funds the bomb programme, and they want to know that their machines are being looked after by people who they can trust. So they put them under naval personnel.
And that's Colossus as well as the bomb.
Yeah, so when the WRENs have proved themselves capable of performing very successfully operating the bombs, mm-hmm. then they shift them onto Colossus when that machine appears as well. That's true, yeah. And as I say, again, in the code-breaking sections, the WRENs work in the naval section. And the ATS work in the military section. And also they do a lot of Army and Air Force traffic analysis. Again, it's quite methodical, quite straightforward work, but it has to be done accurately, promptly, and at a large scale. So it's a perfect job for the ATS to take on. Across the park, quite aside from code breaking, you've got more and more data management work. You've got those communication WAFs, you've got the Hollerith section. That employs women for most of the war, although they do take on a few Wrens later on. And those women are actually recruited locally from the Bletchley area. Not a great pool of manpower in Bletchley, but there are a certain number who are sent on by the local labour exchange and end up in the Hollerith section. And so there are some people who you really wouldn't expect to see at Bletchley Park. People who live just down the road, who had no particular qualifications, who maybe even would have left school and would have had, you know, in the standards of the 1940s, pretty lowly prospects, but they had a part to play in the organisation in the end.
So a very different picture to the early days of the Crosswords and Cardigans type.
Yeah, so the demographics of the organisation really shift as the war goes on. At the start of the war, we had a 50-50 gender split, but the effect of all these women flooding in is that by the end of the war, the proportion of women is up to 75%. So there's a real shift as the war goes on. So Dons and Debs, not a completely inaccurate idea, but it's specific to a particular point in time. And for most of the life of the park, when most people are working here, it's not true.
Our next question is from Sriram on Instagram. And it's, did the Germans ever realise that we were breaking their messages? David.
This is a common question that comes up because people look at the volume of intelligence that Bletchley's producing and the amount of information that the Allies learn about the Germans and the other Axis powers through it and go, but surely somebody on the other side must have suspected something. The short answer is that they did suspect something, but they never were able to prove it to their own satisfaction. This is for a number of reasons. I mean, the British and Bletchley itself from day one are very, very concerned about the security of the system because they know that if, in the case of Enigma, for example, if the Germans get wind of the fact that the system has been compromised, then it would have been quite difficult for them to switch to something else overnight, but they could have made changes to their operating procedures or other minor sort of tweaks to the system that would have made it almost impossible to break. So security was absolutely fundamental. What that means is a variety of ways are used to hide the secret. One of these is the use of cover stories. Even the customers in the UK, so the government departments, the ministries, the military commanders who are given the information, aren't told where it comes from. They're told that it comes from human agents in Germany. There's a code name Boniface, which refers to a fictional spy in Berlin. And the idea is that Boniface is running around going through high-ranking Germans' bins and pulling out information. A lot of the people who deal with Ultra, this charade is seen through fairly quickly, but the pretense is maintained by all the players, even though they kind of know it's not true.
When we're saying about breaking their messages and talking about Ultra, that's not just Enigma, is it?
No. People talk about Enigma all the time, but the Germans, they use a lot of Enigma. The German Navy, 95% of its communications is via Enigma, but they're also using hand code systems. There's also, famously for the Germans, the Lorenz system. And then, of course, you have the Italians who have a variety of systems, the Japanese, the Hungarians, the Romanians. And there's a huge raft of different kind of work going on. And some of it is more secret than other bits. Mm-hmm. Ultra is actually the code phrase that's used to describe German and Japanese high-level communication, so that the really, really top stuff, Enigma and the like, is Ultra. But you get lower security classifications. You get Pearl, for example, which is sort of medium-level codes, often hand systems, pencil-paper systems. One of the myths that has come out of this, and we get asked about it a lot, is the idea that the Allies, and the British government in particular, was reluctant to act on the intelligence because if they did something too obvious, it might give away the secret, the fact that they were reading the messages. That situation certainly exists, but I think it's been overplayed. I mean, you have a scene in the Imitation Game film where they're sort of the codebreakers themselves are trying to decide whether a battleship should be told it's going to be sunk. These things never really happen to that extent, partly because the intelligence is rarely good enough to give you such a black and white choice. And secondly, these decisions weren't the job of Bletchley to make anyway. The information went on to the executive branches of the military who made the actual decisions. And if they wanted to act on a particular piece of intelligence, it was usually possible to come up with a way of disguising the information. The classic myth of all of this is that Churchill let Coventry get bombed because if he'd taken steps to prevent the raid, the secret would have got out. That's not true at all. The story is quite complicated. If you want to dial back through the podcasts, one of our previous episodes, we go into that story in a lot of detail. But Churchill wasn't expecting Coventry to be bombed.
You're quite correct, David. That was episode 40, The Coventry Myth. That was our first It Happened Here episode. But let's just have a small clip from that, because in 2013, we interviewed Sir Arthur Bonsall, who told us the truth about the Coventry myth.
Well, we are correcting myths all the time because of the very nature of Bletchley during the war and the secrecy. It takes people firsthand being absolutely sure, with a pin-sharp memory, that this isn't what happened, this is what happened. So while we've got you, we have to ask you about Coventry and the myth that Churchill knew that that was coming. I gather it's a complete myth.
It is a complete myth. There's not no information relevant to the attack, but it wasn't the sort of information that could have been reported as precise evidence. There were pointers to the fact there might be activity, no date or anything accurate like that. In fact, there were several such other incidents where Enigma traffic had referred to a future raid on somewhere or other in the UK. And I think the reporting staff in Hut 3 always reported this, but it was never any valid. And I was talking to RAF Fighter Command people after. They said it was no good telling us there's going to be a raid two nights ahead, because the chances are the raid won't take place anyhow because the weather won't be suitable. So it's not a definite thing. And in any case, even if it were definite, what could we have done about it? You can't put aircraft up and keep them waiting for a possible arrival. You can only react to actual events. Those reports, warnings of raids on places in Britain were really of no real intelligence value.
What they were careful to do, and I'm going to talk about the Navy in particular as an example, the Navy was relying on a lot of ultra information, knowing where German ships were, knowing where German submarines were, all that sort of thing. But they were very careful to never mention in any of their radio communications out to ships at sea anything about that. And if they wanted to tell a ship that an enemy ship was in a certain location, they would cover it up by suggesting that it had been seen by air reconnaissance, or they'd done direction finding on transmissions from that ship, or whatever. Bismarck famously knew it was being shadowed, but on that occasion, the Enigma messages weren't being read, but the direction finding was able to track the ship. So that was quite true. It is fortunate for the Royal Navy that they didn't mention any ultra in their signals, because right up to 1943, the German Navy are doing a pretty good job of breaking Royal Naval codes. So they are reading a lot of the messages that go out to ships at sea. And that's something that the British are quite slow to counteract. As I say, it's not till 1943 that they really get on top of that. And the convoy codes that are dreamt up to share with the Americans and the Canadians are compromised by the Germans very, very quickly. But such is the discipline with which ultra information is handled by the Admiralty, the Germans are never able to deduce anything from those messages that would give them a hint that their own messages are being read. It becomes slightly wheels within wheels, because it's, you know, one side trying to guess from what they're breaking of the other side, what the other side might be breaking of theirs, and so on. It can melt your brain after a while. But the Germans weren't able to spot anything from the traffic, which was really important. Nonetheless, Dönitz, who was in charge of the U-boats in the early part of the war and went on to be commander of the whole German Navy later on, he was always concerned about his communication security and concerned about Enigma in particular. And more or less each time there was a possible compromise of his codes, he would ask his people to look into it. And as early as February 1940, a U-boat U-33 was sunk off the northwest of England, and it actually sank in shallow enough water that Enigma materials were recovered from it. And Dönitz was concerned that they might be, and he was right to be concerned, because the British did actually get some. But his experts assured him that this wasn't a problem. The man responsible for this perhaps unfortunate conclusion was a chap called Captain Ludwig Stummel, who was Chief of Staff of the Naval Signal Service. The descriptions of him present something of a kind of comedy Nazi. He had a glass eye and a limp, apparently, and was a very strict Nazi and devout Catholic as well, actually. But he went away and he looked into Enigma. And he didn't just look at the machine, he looked at all the procedures surrounding it. And he kind of multiplied up all the factors. He said, firstly, the machine is very secure. You need the key sheets in order to read the messages. The key sheets are printed on water-soluble paper in water-soluble ink. So basically, if you throw the code book in the sea, it all turns to mush. And then the keys are changed very, very frequently, daily, and sheets are issued monthly. So he said, if you add all these factors together, it makes the likelihood of a break infinitesimally small. Actually, we know he was wrong, but he thought because so many separate security measures were being taken by the Germans one after another, that they would add up to impenetrability. Unfortunately, well, fortunately for the Allies, they didn't. One of Stummel's assessments of the security of Enigma has actually come down to us in the archives, and you can hear from this that he is pretty convinced that Enigma is a secure system.
A current reading of our messages by the enemy, without any contradictions, all specialists, in particular those of the Bayedienst headquarters and of the most important specialists of the High Command of the Armed Forces, have determined, in comprehensive work, that the Enigma system is viewed as by far the most resistant of all known methods for secrecy in military communications.
From a captured German document.
Perhaps one of the times Dönitz got most suspicious about Enigma, having mentioned Bismarck, was actually after the sinking of the Bismarck. In order to support Bismarck and Prince Eugen, the German plan was they would wreak havoc in the convoys in the Atlantic. They needed to be resupplied. So a series of oilers and supply ships had been sent out to support Bismarck and Prince Eugen in the Atlantic. After Bismarck had been sunk, those ships were still at sea, and Ultra revealed the locations of all of those vessels. And it would have been easy for the Royal Navy to just go around and sort of pop them all off one by one. But inevitably, had they all been sunk very quickly, it would have been potentially obvious to the Germans that, you know, something was afoot. So three of the ships were sunk. The Belschen, the SO Hamburg, a tanker, and the Egerland were all sunk, but two others, the Gdania and the Gösenheim, were deliberately left off the list and were left alone so that it wouldn't look too obvious. Unfortunately, other Royal Navy ships that weren't part of the plan came across Gdania and Gösenheim by accident and sank them anyway. So in the end, all eight German support ships were sunk within weeks. And this did give the Germans cause to worry that something was definitely up. Again, they had another investigation, but on this occasion, they came to different conclusions that possibly the ships had been sunk by coincidence, which in part was true, two of them had been. They were also quite fearful of spies within their own organisations. You have to remember at this point that the German U-boat operation is being run from Lorient in France and from Paris. So the way I describe it simply is their bins are being emptied by French cleaners. So the risk of espionage within their organisations is quite high. They were also persuaded that British direction finding technology and airborne radar were both very, very effective. And this is assisted by the fact that the British are putting out in their own message traffic that they're finding things using direction finding when actually they're not. They're getting the information through Ultra. So that idea is being reinforced inadvertently by the British themselves. And again, they looked at the multiple efforts of security that they're applying to Enigma and went, no, you couldn't possibly break Enigma, there must be another excuse. However, Dönitz is worried enough to improve the system, and this is one of the reasons why in February 1942, the Atlantic U-boats in particular go over to the M4, the four-rotor Enigma machine. And that's one of the few big changes that happens with Enigma in the course of the war. By and large, the systems that they introduce in 1939 are pretty much in operation in 1945. They're operating on a larger scale, there's more keys involved, and they've introduced minor changes to the system, but it's basically the same system, with the exception of the M4. Towards the end of the war, in 44 and 45, they do introduce additional technology. There are various sort of bolt-on attachments that can be attached to the existing Enigma machine to make it more secure. By this point, they have so many thousand Enigma machines in service that they can't simply withdraw it and replace it with a more secure machine. They had designed a more secure machine, but they hadn't rolled it out, and there was no prospect of them rolling it out in any significant scale by that point in the war. So they produced these sort of attachments that you could bolt on. But even then, those, they're issued and used enough for Bletchley to recognise that they exist and to start to worry about the problem. But they're not actually rolled out in sufficient numbers to make that much difference to the intelligence. So all in all, partly by luck and partly by good planning and partly by German lack of imagination, the Germans never figure out the extent of Bletchley Park's code breaking.
Can I just follow up with a question, David?
Sure.
So my question basically is, would it have mattered if the Germans knew that the Allies were reading Enigma? Because, as you say, distributing the new machines and the new add-on devices was so difficult. And also, you've got to consider a lot of what Bletchley is working on, is relying on, is human error, isn't it? And that would have continued regardless. You've still got to give your cipher machine to an operator who maybe will do daft things with it and cut corners and make mistakes. So what do you think would have happened if the Germans had found out?
It's a difficult one. I completely take your point that they are confronted with a problem. And this is a problem that applies to all military encryption and communication security, that you need systems that are mass producible and are operatable by ordinary soldiers and are robust and work, but are still secure. And Enigma is a really very successful machine because it kind of ticks all those boxes. The problem you would have if you wanted to get rid of it, as you say, is absolutely massive. You can think of things that they might have come up with to eliminate some of the human error and to pick up on some of the procedural changes, you know, that they could have made to make it more secure. And one of the interesting things that came out in some papers released by the Americans a couple of years ago is that the human errors that are identified by Bletchley, there's a tendency for people on this side of the channel to get a bit smug about that and go, you know, those silly old Germans, they were making these mistakes, and both procedurally and through human error. But actually, when the Germans captured some Typex machines after Dunkirk, they started assessing the traffic that they'd intercepted, because obviously they're listening to all our radio messages as well, and they had a big stack of undecrypted Typex traffic. And they started looking at the settings used on the messages and other characteristics of the traffic. And they basically identified all the same human errors that Bletchley was exploiting to break Enigma. And so had they been able to get a little bit more information about Typex, in particular the rotor, they never captured any rotors, had they had a more complete machine, they probably would have exploited the same human errors that we were exploiting of theirs. So it's possible that they could have, you know, got in from their end the same way as we got in from ours. But the thing about the failure of imagination, which I mentioned, which I think is really important here, is none of these German inquiries are saying Enigma is unbreakable. They come back and say Enigma is extraordinarily difficult to break, and it's not possible without an extraordinary effort. You'd need thousands of people, you need factories full of machines in order to read these messages, and no one's going to do that, are they? The point about Bletchley is that it is a factory full of machines for thousands and thousands of people. And so to have the vision to even attempt to do that is the difference, I think. The other question I get asked all the time is, did the Germans know the British were listening to their wireless messages? And the answer is obviously yes. Every country was doing hostile SIGINT against every other country. And the Germans had an expectation that we would be listening to and trying to break into their traffic, same as they were listening to and trying to break into our traffic. That's kind of a given.
Doing all the things like direction finding, which you can do without breaking any of the traffic.
Exactly. And people say, did they know Bletchley existed? The Germans would have taken it as a basic assumption that a Bletchley existed, that there was an organisation doing this kind of work. They had one of their own. Well, they actually had nine of their own. The expectation that your enemy is doing this is obvious. What's not obvious is how successful or unsuccessful they're being. They must have assumed that the Allies were being moderately successful, because the Germans were moderately successful themselves. They broke lots of British codes, lots of American codes, lots of French codes. So you have to assume that your enemy is reading a certain amount of your stuff. It's just exactly how much that's the striking thing in this case.
And that's a really interesting, you know, angle on this question. And maybe it's a bit beyond our remit, but just how important the sort of attitude of the Nazi state is in all of this, and the mindset, the complacency that creates, and the, as you say, the lack of imagination, the inability to think that the enemy might be doing something which is beyond what you yourself are doing. It seems to me it stems from the whole, you know, political basis of Nazi Germany.
And the implications of what that might be if the weaknesses were great enough that Enigma could be read or that existed.
It's a fair point to say that there is a combination of admiration of technology and national arrogance, that they come up with a device that, well, Sherbius has come up with a device that they think is really brilliant. And to say that Enigma doesn't work kind of is to say that the whole German military industrial system doesn't work. It's kind of, for the people that know about it, well, everybody knows about it, it's a fairly common machine. But it's, if you start questioning that, which is supposed to be the most secure and secret thing in the state, then you start questioning everything. And questioning things is not something that Nazis like to do.
Well, also, it speaks to how Hitler actually operated. He gave the same job to different people. So, like you say, there were nine different organisations. They didn't have a Bletchley part. They had 9 very small
multiple parts. Competing Bletchley Parks.
Yeah.
The naval code breakers aren't speaking to the army code breakers, aren't speaking to the SS code breakers, or they're all competing for resources with another and competing for attention with the high command. Part of this thing as well with is Enigma vulnerable is the one thing you don't want to be in the Nazi state is the bearer of bad news. Bearers of bad news end up on the Russian front at best. So your answer is going to be, yeah, everything's fine, you know, because that's culturally how they're operating. Before we get too carried away with that, you have to remember that the US Navy code-breaking department and the US Army code-breaking department aren't talking to each other either. So this isn't a problem that's confined to the Germans. But there is a level of joined-up thinking and organisational coherence at Bletchley, which you just don't find in other countries.
But there is also the ability, it seems, in Britain, in Bletchley, but also many other examples, to give a team a job to do, give them the resources to do it, and then leave them to it. You know, let them use their initiative, you know, without overbearing oversight, without duplicating responsibility and having this sense of competition. It just seems like something that could never happen in Nazi Germany and didn't happen.
And it's also, I'm slightly coy of saying it because it's a bit of a Bletchley cliche, but that idea of sort of thinking outside the box and saying to people, we don't care how you solve this problem, you know, just figure out a way. And if it involves going, you know, all the way around there and back again, that's fine. That's not a problem. You don't have to play the game by the rules in order to get to the solution. And I think that's really important.
You say in Germany, there were a number of different organisations kind of competing, code-breaking organisations. Did Germany have a setup whereby their awareness of the weaknesses of the British Typex machine could help feed into how they viewed the security of Enigma? Or were the code-making and code-breaking sides so separate as well as the different elements of code-breaking?
The Typex as an army was not used by the Royal Navy. It was used by the army. Did the German naval codebreakers even see the Typex?
As far as I understand, the report is from the army codebreakers. But even there, they give up after 6 months or to a year. I can't remember exactly how long it is. And one of their conclusions is this machine looks and functions a lot like an Enigma. So we're probably doomed to fail here because obviously the Enigma is unbreakable. So if this is a pretend Enigma, it's probably going to be unbreakable too. And they kind of reassure themselves that they can't get into it, and they abandon the project by saying, well, all of these machines are unbreakable. It's, you know, no one's going to do it, so we'll give up. I mean, to be fair, Typex has 9 rotors versus 3 and is a more secure machine. It's a kind of second generation Enigma in that way that the people that designed it had already had the chance to see Enigma and how it functioned. So it is a more secure machine anyway. But it was still being operated by signalmen who were just as bored or incompetent as their German colleagues.
Our last question for this podcast comes from Zygmunt on Facebook and Helen on Twitter. And they were wondering, are there any tunnels at Bletchley Park?
We often hear about the tunnels at Bletchley Park. Unfortunately, we do not have the sort of tunnels people expect. All right, the myth is that there's a sort of secret tunnel, especially running from the train station into the park and in various other places. And this was to allow people like Churchill or Eisenhower to visit the park discreetly without anyone knowing it was here. And this feeds into another myth, maybe we'll expand on it another time, that the park was hidden. The park wasn't hidden, it was just secret. You can't hide, you know, a site where 10,000 people work every day. It's just impossible. The locals knew it was here, and you can never hide that.
It's a bit like the donut in Cheltenham.
Exactly.
Everyone knows it's there, but they don't know what goes on inside.
You just don't know what goes on inside. We know that visits by high-ranking figures were frequent. We have the visitor book, which you can see in Hut 11A, which has the names of many, many senior figures in it, and when they visited the bomb section. And we also know that most of these people tended to arrive through the front gate in a sort of cortege of vehicles with pennants flying. And it was to such an extent that some members of staff actually complained that it might be a breach to security because there were too many of these people turning up. It's actually a really obvious way that would make anyone wonder what's going on inside.
So that's why they should build the tunnel, surely.
Yes. So, okay, we don't have any evidence there was a tunnel from the station. Some of our veterans talk about working underground. It's quite interesting to think about this. This may be where some of the myth comes from. The later blocks in the site, they're located on a gentle slope. And especially in block D, if you go in and you head to one side, you will go down flights of steps. The corridor runs down the middle of the building, so there's limited light. It's quite dark and dank.
By steps, we should probably explain, these aren't like the steps you get in a house. These are quite long runs of steps, aren't they?
Yeah, so you will have a flight of steps down, then a run of corridor and another flight of steps down, and it's quite a long building.
If you go in there now, I mean, especially with the windows being boarded up because Block D isn't used, it probably gives you a good impression of how it was during World War II with the blackout, doesn't it?
Which, yeah, exactly. So
there wouldn't be any light, would there?
Yeah, so if you're working at night, there wouldn't be any light because everything would be blacked out and it would be pitch dark and you wouldn't see any natural light. And if you were working in certain rooms, they would have no windows anyway, because if rooms had machinery in it, they would leave the windows off because they wanted to protect the machines in the case of an air raid. This wasn't to protect the people inside because they could always leave and shelter, but with these machines, you couldn't move them in an air raid. So they literally just put them in a windowless room, which would provide sort of blast protection. So if you go into this building every day at night, go down several flights of steps and into a room with no windows, you'd be forgiven for thinking you were working in an underground room. But there are some fairly deep bits, but as far as we know, no parts of the site are actually literally underground. But however, we do have at least one tunnel.
I knew it.
Yes. Not for people, though, but for messages. And this is part of the communication system at the park. As the site got bigger, it was necessary to centralise communications, so they came in one place and then they were distributed to wherever they were needed. And this place was Block E, right in the middle of the park. There were about 1,500 staff working there at its peak. They ran all the equipment, which brought messages in, sorted it, and made sure it got to the right place. And some of the more distant sections were served by runners, but the ones that were closer to Block E, and that's why it was in the middle, were served by conveyor belt or pneumatic tube. So there's a lot of interesting machinery going on. And the conveyor belts, basically, you had... It wasn't a conveyor where the message sits on the belt as it goes along. It was more like there were two lever strips and they were held in tension next to each other. And then you could pull them apart and slide a piece of paper through and it would hold that in tension. And then it would carry it all the way around the system. And that was just used wherever they had a flow of papers coming in that all needed to go to the same place at a regular pace, like, you know, intercepted messages going into Hut 6. So the problem here is that Hut 6 is in Block D at that stage. They retain the name of the hut, even though they're no longer in a hut. And Block D is separated from Block E by a road. You can't remove the road because some sections need to, you know, receive deliveries by a dispatch rider or by car. So the solution was just simply dig a tunnel straight under the road. And if you visit us, it's not in the museum site today, but if you walk up the hill from the car park, you'll see between the two blocks, the sort of concrete emplacements either side of the road, and that's where the tunnel went down. And it was big enough to house a person at least crouching, because we know that when messages would fall off the conveyor, as happened all too often by the sounds of it, it was quite necessary often to send the smallest member of staff, whether they'd be a WAF or a WREN, down the tunnel to retrieve them, which must have been a fairly unpleasant experience. There was known to be quite a lot of frogs down there, which were occasionally fired through the pneumatic tube system.
Actually, Thomas, we've got a lovely anecdote from a veteran called Joyce Begoni, who was a teleprinter operator in Block E.
So, Joyce, this is Block E.
Right.
You probably won't recognise it, but I think this was where you worked from, because this was the communication.
Yeah, you're quite right. I remember I used to creep round the back. There was a loo stuck round the back somewhere and things like that. It looks vaguely familiar. No, I tell you what, I think we did work in a concrete block.
And what was it you did?
Well, I was a teleprinter operator, and I've just realised that they'd got all the coded messages over and they printed it out in written Morse on green paper. Remember that? Then they sent these things to us in written Morse. We translated it into, I think it was five-digit, it was still in code, five-digit things, and it also said in those messages where they needed to go. And we had, it was like a telephone and it was teleprinter because it can't be tapped into. Landline, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And we sent them out by teleprinter, and sometimes you'd work on the switchboard and you could send a message to five or six RAF stations all over the country and you could type it out on one teleprinter.
Right.
Or if you sent it to one, you know.
And how did the information come into you? How did it arrive in your office?
Anybody remembers the old-fashioned haberdashery stores and that they used to have this system where you had a little ball and you put it in and pull a thing and it went along wires. So it used to come from the main office in the front, which was manned by men, presumably, to us. And with the lake just in front there, they took the frogs out of there, used to put it in with a message so that when we got it, we opened it up, a frog jumped out at us. Typical man, wasn't it?
Absolutely brilliant.
you were saying about that picture on the wall.
Yes, well, it must have been one of those places. It does look familiar to that, mate, because it's 70 years ago. There was a lovely picture on the wall of a seaside place where a man was selling ice creams and children were playing on the sand and things. And I was there in 1944, and the war had been very long. We'd been through bombing. And this picture on the wall was a real inspiration. It sort of made you feel, oh, there's sanity in the world somewhere. You know, it was like when I was a child, and it was lovely. And you sort of thought, well, maybe we'll get back to that one day. So that was my picture on the wall. And I'm sorry it isn't still there, because I would love to see it.
Phoebe Senyard says about the conveyor belts. She says, these belts, unfortunately, were not foolproof. And it was no uncommon thing to walk along the main corridor and find a row of signals along the floor which had fallen off in transit. The worst job connected with these belts that my girls had to do was to search the wells up in the ceiling where the belts ran into the upper floor in order to rescue signals which had dropped into them. And since the belts were continuously moving, my girls were scared lest their hair might be caught in them. However, such a thing did not occur, thank goodness. Senyard worked in the naval section, in the section that sorted all these messages as they were coming into the section, which is obviously a very important job to keep everything flowing smoothly to get the information where it needed to go. So we know of this one tunnel. We suspect there may also have been another one that was a similar sort of design running between blocks E and block F. Block F is now demolished, but it was at the top end of the hill. One of our best plans of the park is what we call the 1943 plan, even though it's clearly from a much later date because it shows all the buildings colour-coded according to whether they were demolished or not, including buildings like Block F, which were demolished long after the war, because that building had barely been built in 1943. But it says 1943 on the bottom, so we call it the 1943 plan. And it does seem to be based on a wartime drawing because we can see a lot of the historic fabric is represented on this plan. And it shows a double dotted line between blocks E and F. And it might just be a path, but we have some other evidence as well. There's a photograph taken probably in the early 50s by somebody at the Women's Emergency Teacher Training College, which was set up here after the war and occupied some of the old buildings. And in 1954, they extended part of Block E. And you can see in this photograph that firstly, that where the building is being worked on, and you can also see a very substantial concrete trench running from Block E over towards Block F. And you can't see anything in there to prove that it was a conveyor belt in there, but it does seem like it would be substantial enough, and it does match up with that dotted line on the plan. So we wonder whether there was also a tunnel there. Maybe one day we'll be able to dig a hole and have a look.
So these are kind of services access tunnels, really, almost the equivalent of putting a big pipeline down there, and nothing as dramatic as people have suggested.
No senior military figures sneaking around, sneaking into the park late at night to find out the latest intelligence, just data management, data flow, which was, you know, part and parcel of what most people here, you know, at the end of the war were doing. They were not doing deep intellectual work. They were not at the coalface. They were doing support work. They were making sure messages coming in got to where they needed to go promptly and efficiently. And that was as important as anything the codebreakers were doing.
Yeah, I don't think we would have got Winston in one of the tunnels, would we? He was slightly...
You might have got him in. You probably wouldn't have got him out again. The only other underground bit I'm thinking of, when you were talking about the machines being secured in windowless buildings and the people evacuated, there was one large underground air raid shelter out the back of Hut 4, which is now under our children's play area. And that was basically, there was a stepped entrance and you went in, and then there was a tunnel running in a sort of T-shape right and left with sort of bays off it with benches in. So you could accommodate several hundred people down there.
You can still see some recesses
in the
ground.
You can see the top of it because... Yeah. After the war, it wasn't that deeply buried, so they basically uncovered it, filled all the void space with rubble and rubbish, and then put the soil back on top. And the soil has subsided slightly now, so you can see the sort of the footprint of it. And some of the brickwork around where the entrance originally was is still visible as well. So people were going underground, but, well, they would have gone underground if there was an air raid, but there was never an air raid proper.
There was a lot of talk, obviously, people were, during the war, were worried about the site being bombed. So there was a lot of talk about camouflaging it and whether, if they built a new block, it would be too conspicuous. And the reason given for the location of the first two blocks, blocks A and block B, obviously, by the lake there is because they're concealed by the trees somewhat, and that gives a bit of protection. They get bombed by accident a bit in 1940, but it's complete random chance that this German bomber happens to jettison its load over Bletchley. And I think later in the war, they decide it's not a serious threat anymore and they build whatever they want, wherever they want.
And also, I think the blocks, the later blocks, like Block C and Block D, it's quite a standard British design for municipal buildings during that time, isn't it?
Yeah, again, we're back to the fact the site is secret, but it's not hidden.
Yeah.
So it looks like any other wartime
They are described as splinter-proof, those buildings. The idea was that, although they have windows, if you got down on the floor or under your desk or whatever, you would survive anything but a direct hit, really. The ceiling, you can look at the side of the building, in Block A, certainly, which is 2 stories tall, the first floor is a good 15 inches thick of solid concrete. Is why our offices are all freezing in summer and freezing in winter.
That makes sense as well. If there's one bomb shelter on site next to the mansion, which isn't bomb-proof necessarily, but that the buildings, as they're building them, are more and more capable of sheltering the staff or, as Tom said, more importantly, the machines.
Yeah.
But there isn't some hidden network of other air raid shelters on the site.
No. We get inquiries regularly about mysterious, undiscovered things.
Mm.
But part of the problem we have is that people believe that we're still keeping things secret and that if they existed, we wouldn't tell them anyway. But, yeah. You know,
we do not work for GCHQ. We are very good friends with GCHQ and they help us out very often. But we are not bound by the Official Secrets Act and we can say whatever we want.
Or can we?
Or can we?
So I think we'll call that quits for this episode. We haven't got as many questions answered as we wanted to, so I'm breaking this to the team now. We will reconvene in January and we'll do part two of these answers. So if you're a listener or you follow us on social media and your question hasn't been answered yet, there's a good chance it'll be answered in January. So from all of us here in the podcast team, it's goodbye for now and we will see you in 2021.
Bye.
Bye.
Merry Christmas.
Bye. Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.